on background, warned against any extra-constitutional measures by Pakistan's army. In Rawalpindi, Musharraf and his officers fumed. Why did they need another lecture about democracy from the Americans? Who said they were about to launch a coup anyway? It was Sharif who was the greater danger to Pakistan. And what kind of game was his crony, General Ziauddin, cooking up at the CIA? In the parlors of Islamabad's and Rawalpindi's elite, where conspiracy talk is appetizer and aperitif, suspicion piled upon suspicion as September ended. Ziauddin heard an earful at Foggy Bottom from Undersecretary of State Pickering, who urged the ISI chief to intervene personally with Mullah Omar about bin Laden. In desperate need of allies, Sharif and his intelligence chief wanted to do all they could to ingratiate themselves with the CIA. Ziauddin flew into Kandahar on October 7 and met with Omar to tell him how strongly the Americans felt about bin Laden. The Taliban leader, as he had so many times before, rebuffed him. Sharif tried again to ease the tension. He appointed Musharraf to the additional post of chairman of Pakistan's Joint Chiefs of Staff. This was a largely symbolic job, but Sharif had left it open for a year, creating the impression that he might use it to kick Musharraf upstairs, out of direct army command. Now Sharif seemed to make clear that he did not want Musharraf to go. The general felt relaxed enough to take his wife on a working golf junket to Sri Lanka. Bill Milam forecast a temporary peace and left for vacation in California. On October 12, 1999, as Musharraf flew back to Karachi on a Pakistan International Airlines jet, Nawaz Sharif announced that he was firing his army chief. Against all protocol, he elevated Ziauddin to take Musharraf's place. Ziauddin had few friends among the powerful Army Corps commanders. He had risen as an engineer on the Army's margins, and his turn at ISI had won him more allies in Langley than in Rawalpindi. He had so few connections in general headquarters that when Sharif told him of his promotion, Ziauddin had to shop for the proper epaulettes in a commercial market in Rawalpindi, according to accounts that later reached the U.S. Embassy. The first hours after Sharif's stunning decision unfolded in confusion. It took time for word of Musharraf's dismissal to circulate among senior generals and for them to discuss a response. They intended to hold to military discipline. Musharraf was still in charge, but he was airborne and difficult to reach. The CIA-funded secret anti-bin Laden commando force on the Afghan border now teetered in the balance. As the new army chief on paper, Ziauddin called the commandos to the capital to help defend his new office and Nawaz Sharif. There were not many of them, but they could provide a lethal bodyguard. The commando team's leaders knew that in political terms they were Ziauddin's men. If they moved now on his behalf, they might reap rewards. But if they tried to defend the general against a hostile army command, they could find themselves under arrest or worse. In the first hours, several of the commando team's officers, dressed in plain clothes, moved quietly into Rawalpindi to assess how Ziauddin's faction was doing. They did not want to commit until they could estimate their chances of success. According to accounts later circulated by the CIA, the commando team leaders quickly discovered the army's outrage about Musharraf's dismissal. The high command intended to move against Sharif and his allies. The army's 10th Corps, the politically sensitive unit barracked nearest to Islamabad, soon rolled into the streets to detain Sharif and his political allies, including Ziauddin. Without calling attention to themselves, the commando leaders hurriedly communicated to their men, "This is a losing cause." "That unit disappeared almost overnight," an American official recalled. "I mean, it just dissolved." By one Pakistani account, some of the commandos had become uneasy about their mission against bin Laden. Another U.S. official who was managing the coup crisis in Washington remembered, "The expression I did hear was that they were heading for the hills and haven't been heard from since." Desperate, Sharif ordered the Karachi airport to refuse permission for Musharraf's plane to land. The jet had only 20 minutes of fuel left, the pilot reported. Circling above the Arabian Sea, the airplane pitched and turned. "The hostess was white as a sheet," recalled Musharraf's wife, Sheba. "Two anti-hijacking guards had come forward, We were gaining and losing height. I could see the lights of Karachi receding. The army prevailed on the controllers, and the plane landed. Musharraf barely had time to absorb that he was now Pakistan's supreme leader. Wearing mismatched civilian clothes hurriedly borrowed, he interrupted the bland folk dancing that had soothed viewers of state-run television during the crisis. Backed by tanks now spreading across Pakistan's major cities, Musharraf declared that a new political era in Pakistan had begun and that Sharif had been dismissed. A day later, he issued an emergency decree and appointed himself chief executive. The coup severely disrupted the Clinton administration's covert campaign against bin Laden. Musharraf immediately arrested Ziauddin. The ISI-supplied, CIA-trained commando team was lost. Richard Clark and others at the National Security Council had invested little hope in the group, but some CIA officers thought there was at least a 25% chance it might have gone into action around Kandahar. Pakistani intelligence was in for another leadership upheaval. Musharraf had personal cause for suspicion of his own intelligence service. ISI's internal security group had investigated the general's suitability for high office when Sharif was considering him for army chief, Musharraf complained angrily. Now he would have to clean house at ISI to make sure that it was under control, loyal to his new government, and not off running private errands for Clinton or the CIA. Bill Milam flew back hurriedly to Islamabad and met Musharraf privately at 11 a.m. on Friday, October 15, at General Headquarters in Rawalpindi. Musharraf wore his uniform and surrounded himself with aides. He seemed uncomfortable. Milam had met with Musharraf monthly over the previous year. At first, the discussions had been formal and constrained. Gradually, they evolved into private, more candid talks. Now Milam handed Musharraf a letter from President Clinton. It chastised the general for taking power and urged him to establish a roadmap for restoring democracy. If they discussed any issue besides the army takeover, it was only in passing. Musharraf explained his reasons. Sharif had pulled Pakistan down to one of the lowest points in its history. The general unfurled a long account of his hours on the PIA jet, uncertain of his fate. He was actually, clearly quite angry with Nawaz, recalled an American involved. He thought Nawaz was trying to kill him. Milam knew from his previous meetings that Musharraf had traditional, uncompromising views about Afghanistan and Kashmir. By the time of the coup, Musharraf and his corps commanders felt that the Americans had adopted a certain approach towards the Taliban without really understanding what the Taliban was all about, as one senior Pakistani official close to the general put it. Musharraf believed that by marginalizing the Taliban, the Clinton administration had made them more dependent on the Arabs, and therefore the United States had ended up with a self-fulfilling prophecy of rising terrorism. Musharraf wanted Clinton to engage with the Taliban, to seek their moderation, and to win the hearts and minds of Afghans. Clinton's cabinet split over how to react to Musharraf's takeover. Richard Clark and his allies in the counterterrorism bureaucracy did not want to alienate Musharraf for fear that he would make a difficult bin Laden problem even worse. Albright and others argued that, given Clinton's emphasis on the promotion of democracy worldwide, it would be hypocritical to accept an army-led coup against an elected prime minister, however great Sharif's flaws. Musharraf was the architect of Kargil, she and other skeptics pointed out. He facilitated terrorism in Kashmir. The whole debate about how bad Musharraf might be diverted the discussion about counterterrorism in the cabinet and at the White House, one participant recalled. The coup introduced a whole new issue in our bilateral relationship. In addition to Kashmir, in addition to proliferation, now there was the issue about the return to democracy. With Pakistan, at least, bin Laden and al-Qaeda were slipping yet further down the list. As celebrations of the end of the millennium and the dawn of 2000 neared, George Tenet called his old mentor from his days on Capitol Hill, the former senator from Oklahoma, David Boren. "Don't travel," Tenet told him. "Don't go any place where there are big crowds." Boren was incredulous. "Oh, come on, George," he said dismissively. "No, no, no," Tenet answered serious. You don't understand. You don't understand people like Bin Laden. Boren thought Tenet sounded obsessive, but he paid attention. It had been a rough autumn for the threat reporting managers at the CIA's counter-terrorist center. Beginning in September, they picked up multiple signs that Bin Laden had set in motion major terrorist attacks timed to the turn of the year. Jordan's security services tapped telephones of suspected Al-Qaeda members and began to gather evidence about one apparent plot to hit American and Israeli targets. There were many other ominous fragments in the CIA's daily threat matrix. Tenet went to the White House to deliver a forecast. He expected between 5 and 15 terrorist attacks around the millennium. "Because the U.S. is Bin Laden's ultimate goal," Tenet reported, "we must assume that several of these targets will be in the U.S. He grabbed the National Security Council's attention with that prediction. Yet there was still an undercurrent of tension between Richard Clark's office at the White House and the Counterterrorist Center at the CIA over how much threat reporting was too much. Clark's two principal aides at the time, Stephen Simon and Daniel Benjamin, wrote later that the CIA was still overloading the president's daily brief that autumn with alarming but inconclusive threat reports, so great was the fear of failing to give timely notice. This sort of caustic skepticism about CIA motivations frustrated Langley's officers. They believed the White House, especially Clark's office, would be the first to pounce on them if they failed to pass along a relevant warning. Two arrests, one made public at the time, the other kept secret initially, shocked them all into panicked cooperation. On November 30, Jordanian intelligence listened as one of Bin Laden's top lieutenants, Abu Zubaydah, gave orders by international telephone to begin carrying out an attack he called the Day of the Millennium. Jordanian police swooped down on the Amman houses they had under surveillance. In the early hours of December 5, a militant in custody led them to a house with a false floor covered by cinder blocks. Beneath an iron hatch and down a ladder, they found 71 plastic containers of nitric acid and sulfuric acid. It was enough for explosives as powerful as 16 tons of TNT, enough to destroy a hotel and the neighborhood around it. The Islamists arrested confessed they had already picked a target, a Radisson hotel that expected to host American and Israeli tourists for a gala millennium party. The suspects admitted to another plan. They intended to release cyanide gas inside a crowded movie theater that was popular with foreigners. National Security Advisor Sandy Berger convened daily hour-long White House meetings to review every thread of intelligence, surveillance, and warning available. The interagency group issued streams of nationwide and international alerts. From Langley, Tenet, and Kofor Black cabled stations worldwide. They ordered intensified collection and disruption campaigns against any known Islamist individuals or groups whose records suggested they might be involved in the Millennium attacks. They sought to target operations we knew were being planned for the Millennium turnover, as one CIA officer at the Counterterrorist Center recalled, and that we suspected would carry over to the end of the Muslim month of Ramadan in early January 2000. 9 days after the explosives cache was unearthed in Jordan, a watchful customs agent named Diane Dean saw a Middle Eastern man sweat profusely as he sat in the back of a line of cars exiting a ferry from Canada through Port Angeles, Washington. She popped the trunk of the man's Chrysler and found enough explosives to level a section of the Los Angeles International Airport, which he later admitted was his target. Ahmed Rassam, an Algerian, had migrated to Canada, fallen in with a cell of Montreal Islamists, and then traveled to Afghanistan to enroll in camps run by Bin Laden. His proximity to America attracted Bin Laden's recruiters, and he was enrolled in graduate-level training in explosives at Darunta, a camp near Jalalabad. In mid-January 1999, Rassam departed from Afghanistan with $12,000 in cash and extensive course notes about how to build a devastating bomb. After Rassam's arrest, Clinton telephoned General Musharraf in Pakistan. He demanded that Musharraf find a way to disrupt or arrest Bin Laden, according to notes of the conversation kept by the American side. Musharraf's coup offered a potential fresh start in U.S.-Pakistan relations, Clinton said. But the potential benefits of a renewal, economic aid, and trade relief, depended on whether Pakistan's army helped remove bin Laden as a threat. Musharraf pledged to cooperate, but he was unwilling to take the political heat at home, cabled U.S. Ambassador William Milam. Clark and the CIA's Counter-Terrorist Center spent New Year's Eve in restless watch for last-minute evidence of an attack. Midnight struck, but no terrorists did. As it happened, they had missed one bin Laden team on the verge of an assault. In Yemen, a team of suicide bombers moved against the USS The Sullivans, an American destroyer, as it docked at Aden just after New Year's Day. But the plotters overloaded their suicide skiff with explosives and struggled helplessly as it sank in the harbor. They salvaged the boat, but it would be months before they could organize another attack. Nobody noticed them. At the CIA's Counter-Terrorist Center, "We were frantic," Kofor Black recalled. "Nobody was sleeping. We were going full tilt." They had launched the largest collection and disruption activity in the history of mankind against terrorism, he recalled, with hundreds of operations underway simultaneously. In the midst of this surge, a piece of intelligence originally turned up by the FBI during its investigations of the Africa embassy bombings provided a kind of tuning fork that buzzed, as one CIA officer later put it. A phone tap in the Middle East indicated that two Arab men with links to Al-Qaeda planned a trip to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. A counter-terrorist center officer noticed the connections and sought approval for surveillance operations to try to learn the men's names and, ideally, what they were doing, as the CIA officer put it. By January 5, 2000, the CIA had obtained a copy of one of their targets' passports. Khalid al-Midar, a middle-class Saudi Arabian with no known links to terrorism, had been issued a U.S. B-1, B-2 multiple-entry visa in Jeddah the previous spring, a visa that would not expire until April 6, 2000, the passport showed. Working with a Malaysian internal security unit that cooperated regularly with the CIA station in Kuala Lumpur, officers photographed the suspects in and around a golf course condominium owned by an Islamic radical named Yazid Sofat. The group included a number of known or suspected Al-Qaeda terrorists. "We surveilled them. We surveilled the guy they're there to meet," Black recalled. "Not close enough to hear what they're actually saying, but we're covering, taking pictures, watching their behavior. They're acting kind of spooky. They're not using the phone in the apartment. They're going around, walking in circles, just like junior spies, going up to phone booths, making a lot of calls. It's like, who are these dudes?" The Counter-Terrorist Center briefed Tenet and FBI Director Louis Free, but when al-Midar and his companions flew out of Kuala Lumpur, the CIA lost their trail. "Thus far, a lot of suspicious activity has been observed, but nothing that would indicate evidence of an impending attack or criminal enterprise," one CIA officer wrote to another that week. The email's author had recently been posted to the Counter-Terrorist Center to help improve communication with the FBI. The officer reported that the FBI had been told, "As soon as something concrete is developed leading us into the criminal arena or to known FBI cases, we will immediately bring FBI into the loop." None of the CIA officers at the Counter-Terrorist Center who knew about al-Midar's valid American visa, and none of the FBI officers who were briefed, thought to place al-Midar on official American terrorist watch lists. A Counter-Terrorist Center circular had reminded officers of proper watch listing procedures only weeks earlier. These lists were designed to alert customs, law enforcement, and immigration officers to the names of those whose entry to the United States should be blocked or reviewed. The CIA at the time was adding several hundred names to the watch list every month. The agency's lapse in al-Midar's case, Tenet said later, was caused by a combination of inadequate training of some of our officers, their intense focus on achieving the objectives of the operation itself, determining whether the Kuala Lumpur meeting was a prelude to a terrorist attack, and the extraordinary pace of operational activity at the time. The first error in January was compounded by another weeks later when the CIA discovered that the second Saudi identified in Malaysia, Nawaf al-Hazmi, had flown to Los Angeles on January 15, 2000, and entered the United States. A March 5 cable to Langley from a CIA station abroad reporting this fact did not trigger a review of either of the Saudis, nor was either of them placed on the watch list at this second opportunity. As it happened, both men were al-Qaeda veterans of wars in Afghanistan and Bosnia. Without the watch list, there was little chance the suspects would face scrutiny. Under the State Department's consular policies, as one investigator later put it, Saudi Arabia was one of the countries that did not fit the profile for terrorism or illegal immigration. For all of its sour experiences with the Saudi government on terrorism issues, and for all of the mutual frustration and suspicion dating back two decades, the United States was still loath to re-examine any of the core assumptions governing its alliance with Riyadh. Beyond the names of the two mysterious Saudis and the inconclusive photography relayed from Kuala Lumpur, the CIA knew nothing at this stage about the multi-stranded plot that bin Laden had set in motion in Kandahar late in 1999 to attack American aviation. What Tenet did know about al-Qaeda that winter frightened him more than ever before. The cyanide plot in Jordan and the evidence of populist Algerian networks in Canada and Europe stunned the CIA director and his senior colleagues. Among other things, the new cases reinforced Tenet's fears about bin Laden's ambitions to use weapons of mass destruction. Taken together, the evidence confirms our conviction, Tenet told the Senate Intelligence Committee on February 2, that bin Laden wants to strike further blows against America and is placing increased emphasis on developing surrogates to carry out attacks in an effort to avoid detection. Al-Qaeda had now emerged as an intricate web of alliances among Sunni extremists worldwide, including North Africans, radical Palestinians, Pakistanis, and Central Asians, Tenet warned. The Taliban was an increasingly obvious part of the problem, he said. Illicit profits that the Taliban reaped from opium trafficking reached extremists such as bin Laden to support their campaign of terrorism. Still, in this briefing and others to the intelligence committees that winter, as he delivered his warnings in rough order of priority, Tenet continued to place the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction just ahead of the danger of terrorism. It is simply not enough to look at al-Qaeda in isolation, Tenet explained later. The 1990s saw a number of conflicting and competing trends. He felt he could not concentrate only on terrorism. The CIA had to provide intelligence for American military forces deployed worldwide. It had to watch nuclear proliferation, chemical and biological weapons, tensions in the Middle East, and other pressing issues, and do so with far fewer intelligence dollars and manpower than in the past. The senators, for their part, spent more time that February grilling Tenet about a controversy over the use of classified information by his predecessor at the CIA, John Deutsch, than they did asking questions about bin Laden, Afghanistan, or the threat of spectacular terrorism. For all of the CIA's global surge that winter, none of the wiretaps or interrogation reports picked up evidence of the four Arab men from Hamburg who had moved quietly in and out of Afghanistan that winter. The CIA and FBI pressed Germany's police continually for help in watching Islamists in that country, including in Hamburg, but the efforts were frustrated by German laws and attitudes. Only half a century removed from the Nazi Gestapo, German courts adamantly limited police spying. Many German politicians and intellectuals saw American fears of Islamic terrorism as overblown, even naive. Nor did CIA cooperation with Pakistani intelligence yield day-to-day exchanges about Arab men entering and leaving the country on Taliban-sponsored visits to Afghanistan. In any event, the Hamburg Four finalized their plans for pilot training in the United States without attracting attention from police or intelligence agencies. Marwan al-Shehi fell into conversation that spring with a Hamburg librarian, Angela Dwile, as he prepared to depart for America. "Something will happen, and there will be thousands dead," he told her. He mentioned the World Trade Center, she recalled. She did not think he was serious. 27. You crazy white guys. A few weeks after the millennium had passed, the CIA's counterterrorist center picked up intelligence that Osama bin Laden had arrived in Darunta camp, in a jagged valley near Jalalabad. The camp had become a focus of White House and CIA intelligence collection efforts. It was a typical bin Laden facility, crude, mainly dirt and rocks, with a few modest buildings protected by ridges. Massoud's intelligence sources reported that no Afghans were permitted in Darunta, only Arabs. Testimony from al-Qaeda defectors and interrogation of Arab jihadists showed that Darunta was a graduate school for elite recruits. Ahmed Rissam had trained there. Richard Clark's counterterrorism security group had examined evidence that al-Qaeda pursued experiments with poisons and chemical weapons at Darunta. The Defense Intelligence Agency had reported about a year before the millennium that bin Laden aides were developing chemical arms at the camp. The Pentagon routed satellites above Darunta and took pictures. The CIA recruited Afghan agents who traveled or lived in the Jalalabad region. It was an area of high mobility and weak Taliban control, and it did not take long for the agency to develop sources. Through its new liaison in the Panjshir, the counterterrorist center pushed technical intelligence collection equipment to Massoud's southern lines. These efforts produced intercepts of Taliban radio traffic in Kabul and Jalalabad. In addition, the CIA inserted an optical device derived from technology used by offshore spy planes that could produce photographic images from a distance of more than 10 miles. Massoud's men, with help from CIA officers, set up an overlook above Darunta and tried to watch the place with the agency's high-tech spyglass. This intense collection effort did not produce conclusive evidence that bin Laden possessed chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons, but it showed that he wanted them. The Darunta reporting fed Tenet's fear that bin Laden's acquisition of weapons of mass destruction was a serious prospect. The counterterrorist center relayed its report to Massoud that bin Laden had arrived in Darunta. Bin Laden frequently inspected training camps where he met with lieutenants, made speeches, and shot a few guns. He moved continuously in unannounced zigzag loops around Afghanistan. He lectured at mosques, received delegations, and graced banquets with his presence, always surrounded by dozens of Arab bodyguards. Darunta was a regular stop. Massoud ordered a mission on the basis of the CIA's report. He rounded up a bunch of mules, as an American official put it, and loaded them up with Soviet-designed Katyusha rockets. He dispatched a small commando team toward Darunta. Massoud's shifting southern lines often allowed his men to move within artillery distance of Kabul and Jalalabad. Fighters who knew the terrain could walk on footpaths through the mountains to secure elevated firing positions. After the team was on its way, Massoud reported his plan to Langley. The CIA's lawyers convulsed in alarm. The White House legal authorities that provided guidance for the new liaison with Massoud had not authorized pure lethal operations against bin Laden. The Massoud partnership, for now, was supposed to be about intelligence collection. Now the CIA had, in effect, provided intelligence for a rocket attack on Darunta. The CIA was legally complicit in Massoud's operation, the lawyers feared, and the agency had no authority to be involved. The bin Laden unit at Langley shot a message to the Panjshir. You've got to recall the mission. We have no legal standing to provide intelligence that will be used in rocket attacks against bin Laden, the CIA officers pleaded. Massoud's aides replied, in effect, as an American official put it, What do you think this is, the 82nd Airborne? We're on mules. They're gone. There was no way to reach the attack team. They did not carry satellite phones or portable radios. They were walking to their launch site, and then they would fire off their rockets, turn around, and walk back. Langley's officers waited nervously. Some of them muttered sarcastically about the absurd intersections of American law and a secret war they were expected to manage. The worst case would be if the rocket attack went badly and killed innocent civilians. The best case would be if Massoud's men killed bin Laden. They could take the heat if that happened. Days passed, and then weeks. Massoud's aides eventually reported that they had, in fact, shelled Darunta camp. But the CIA could pick up no independent confirmation of the attack or its consequences. The lawyers relaxed, and the incident passed unpublicized. For the bin Laden unit's officers, the episode only underlined the issues Massoud had emphasized at their meetings in the Panjshir. Why was the United States unable to choose sides more firmly in Massoud's war against the Taliban? What is our policy toward Afghanistan? The bin Laden unit officers demanded in agency discussions. Is it counterterrorism? Is it political? Although Clark was a relative hawk on bin Laden in the Clinton cabinet, increasingly, Kofor Black and his colleagues at the Counterterrorist Center resented the role played by the White House-run Counterterrorism Security Group. They were in broad agreement about the seriousness of the bin Laden threat, but the CIA's field operatives, we who actually did things, as one of them put it, sought only two kinds of support from Clark's White House team, funding and permissive policy guidance. By 1999, they felt increasingly that Clark and Berger could not or would not deliver on either front. We certainly were not better off by their intervention in ops matters, in which they had no experience, recalled one officer involved. In the CIA's executive suites, Tenet and Clandestine Service Chief James Pavitt stressed that Langley would not make policy on its own. That was the lesson of the Iran-Contra debacle, they believed. For their part, Clark and his White House colleagues repeatedly questioned the CIA's ability to act creatively and decisively against bin Laden. Clark felt that the current generation of CIA officers had overlearned the lessons of the 1960s and 1980s, that covert action is risky and likely to blow up in your face. Clinton's cabinet lacked confidence in its spy service. Explaining what she perceived to be CIA caution in the field, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright quipped to her cabinet colleagues that, because of the scandals and trials suffered during earlier decades, the CIA's active generation of field officers were still coping with the deep bruises of their abused childhood. Under the revised guidelines, the CIA and Massoud's men could only develop plans for bin Laden's capture. They needed to have a way to bundle him up and fly him out of Afghanistan as part of the plan. Massoud's men could use lethal force if they encountered resistance from bin Laden's bodyguards, as they almost certainly would. The CIA also still had to avoid any action that would fundamentally alter Massoud's military position against the Taliban. Albright and Berger continued to believe that providing covert military aid to Massoud would only lead to more Afghan civilian deaths while prolonging the country's military stalemate. Massoud's forces were too small and too discredited by their past atrocities to ever overthrow the Taliban or unite the country, they and their many analysts inside the State Department believed. Increasingly, the White House and even senior CIA managers such as Kofor Black worried as well about Pakistan's stability. If they angered Pakistan's army by embracing the Taliban's enemy, Massoud, this could destroy the Clinton administration's attempt to negotiate controls on Islamabad's nuclear weapons program. As so often before, Pakistan's Islamist-tinged elite managed to appear just dangerous and unpredictable enough to intimidate American officials. The Pentagon, especially General Anthony Zinni at CENTCOM, who remained close to Musharraf personally, emphasized engagement with Pakistan's generals. To covertly provide weapons or battlefield intelligence to Massoud would be to join India, among others, in a proxy war against Pakistan. Zinni also opposed more missile strikes in Afghanistan. On the front lines of the Panjshir Valley, Massoud and his men took a jaundiced view of American priorities. Episodes like the Darunta attack confused and entertained them. "We were puzzled," remembered one of Massoud's senior aides. "What was unlethal operations if you have an enemy that is armed to the teeth? They have everything. Then you are not allowed to have lethal operations against him?" Still, Massoud recognized that the CIA represented a democracy. They represented an organized society where institutions function with restrictions, as the senior aide recalled. Massoud also believed that within the American bureaucracy, intelligence people are always aggressive. Massoud and his advisors were confident that the CIA wished to do a lot in Afghanistan, but their hands were tied. It was not intelligence failure. It was political failure. when they met with visiting CIA officers or exchanged messages about the new detailed rules for operations against bin Laden, even after the Darunta attack. "We never heard the word kill from any American we talked to," the senior Massoud aide remembered. "And I can tell you that most of the individuals who were reading these legal notes were also laughing. It was not their draft." For two decades, Massoud had watched in frustration as the United States deferred to Pakistan in its policies toward Afghanistan. In that sense, the Clinton administration's policy was not new. Massoud understood that Washington's relationship with Pakistan was considered strategic, as his senior aide put it. Pakistan's interference in Afghanistan was considered a minor issue, and so the United States ignored it. This continuing American deference to Islamabad fueled Massoud's cynicism about the CIA's campaign against bin Laden, however. About a dozen Americans had died in the Africa embassy bombings. Many hundreds of Afghan civilians, the kin of Massoud's commanders and guerrillas, had been slaughtered soon afterward by Taliban forces on the Somali plains north of Kabul. Yet American law did not indict the Taliban masterminds of the Somali massacres. It did not permit military aid to attack the Taliban. American politicians rarely even spoke about these massacres. This seemed, to some of Massoud's men, a profound and even unforgivable kind of hypocrisy. George Tenet's exhortations about bin Laden cascaded through the CIA. It was rare for the Director of Central Intelligence to personally invest himself in a single counterterrorist mission, as Tenet had done. The result during 1999 and early 2000 was a surge in recruitments of unilateral agents who could operate or travel in Afghanistan. It was the largest CIA drive for unilateral Afghan agents since the late years of the anti-Soviet war. Near East Division case officers and officers dispatched by the Counterterrorist Center sought contact with every potential Afghan source they could find. Some might be informal sources, helping the CIA because of their political opposition to the Taliban. Others were recruited secretly onto the CIA's unilateral payroll. Case officers began to turn some Taliban military leaders, including a brigade-level commander in eastern Afghanistan. One energetic young case officer operating from Islamabad single-handedly recruited 6 or 7 Taliban commanders operating in eastern Afghan border regions. The Islamabad-based case officers also contacted every Mujahideen veteran of the anti-Soviet period who was known to the CIA. These included old commanders with Abdurrab Rasul Sayaf, who is now an ally of Massoud and opposed to the Taliban. Shiite commanders who had worked with the CIA around Kabul during the late 1980s, and Pashtun elders and political figures who spent most of their time in Pakistan, but who had kin networks in eastern Afghanistan and sometimes traveled across the border. An exception was Abdul Haq, still regarded as unreliable by his former CIA allies. All of these recruitments and contacts were kept secret from Pakistani intelligence, just as the unilateral program had been in the late 1980s. None of the recruited agents was close to bin Laden. Despite several years of effort, the CIA had been unable to recruit a single agent inside the core al-Qaeda leadership. Black knew that the CIA was in trouble without penetrations of the UBL organization, as a classified counterterrorist center briefing to Clinton's National Security Small Group put it late in 1999. "While we need to disrupt operations, we need also to recruit sources," Black's briefing documents declared, even though recruiting terrorist sources is difficult. Still, the growing size of the CIA's private agent network on the edges of the leadership, Tenet said later, could be measured in the agent reports that flowed through Langley headquarters. In 1999, for the first time, the CIA generated more unilateral reports about bin Laden from its own agents than reports from liaisons with other intelligence agencies. The Defense Intelligence Agency, working its own Pakistani and Afghan sources, produced scores of its own classified reports about bin Laden. One purpose of the recruitments was to collect detailed intelligence about bin Laden's movements, his training camps, the houses where he stayed, the houses where his wives stayed, and the houses where al-Zawahiri, Mohammed Atif, and other top lieutenants lived or worked. Gradually, the CIA built up a detailed map of bin Laden's infrastructure in Afghanistan. Reports and photography from unilateral agents were matched against satellite imagery to fill in maps of camps and urban neighborhoods. Bin Laden practiced intensive operational security. He was wary of telephones. He allowed no Afghans into his personal bodyguard, only Arabs he had known and trusted for many years. He varied his routes, did not stay in any one place for long, and never told anyone but his Arab inner circle about his plans. These practices limited the effectiveness of the CIA's recruitments because the agency's sources and paid agents were mainly Afghans who were kept at bay by bin Laden's core bodyguard and leadership group. The CIA was unable to penetrate the inner circle, but bin Laden did have one security weakness, as agency operatives saw it, his several wives. Even after it was obvious that the Americans knew about Tarnak Farm near Kandahar, for example, bin Laden kept one of his families there and visited regularly. As a pious Muslim, he tried to follow the Islamic practice of treating all his wives equally. The women had nearly identical lodging. At one point, the CIA believed bin Laden had two different wives in Kabul. He would visit their houses regularly. The Islamabad station, through its tribal agents in Kandahar, recruited an Afghan who worked as a security guard at one of the Kabul houses bin Laden used. But the agent was so far down the al-Qaeda information chain that he never knew when bin Laden was going to turn up. He was summoned to guard duty just as the Saudis' land cruisers rolled in, and it was difficult to get a message out before bin Laden was gone again. We occasionally learned where bin Laden had been, or where he might be going, or where someone who looked a little like him might be, Madeleine Albright recalled. We heard of suspicious caravans or of someone tall with a beard moving about with bodyguards. It was maddening. The CIA's agent networks and operational problems were different in each of the cities where bin Laden stayed. The agency had the best coverage around Kandahar, where its core group of paid tribal assets had been operating for years. Their reporting was now supplemented by swelling networks of anti-Taliban Pashtun activists who could move in and out of the region from Pakistan with ease. Any time he went to Kandahar, we would know it, an American official recalled. We had very good sources in Kandahar. The problem was, nobody could say where he was going to be the next day at noon. Kandahar was also the Taliban's military stronghold. Even if the CIA pinpointed bin Laden downtown, there was no easy way to organize a snatch operation. The attacking force would face strong opposition from Taliban units. There was also a likelihood of civilian casualties if the White House ordered missile strikes in the city. Besides, American counterterrorism policy did not identify Mullah Omar or the Taliban as the enemy. By Clinton's declared policy at the United Nations and elsewhere, the Taliban was not fair game for targeted strikes. It would be less complicated to catch bin Laden at a training camp, on a road in rural Kandahar, or in nearby Uruzgan province, Mullah Omar's home. In the summer of 1999, a truck bomb detonated outside Omar's downtown Kandahar house, killing and wounding some of his relatives. In the aftermath, bin Laden used his wealth to construct new compounds for the Taliban leader. He built Omar an extravagant, unapproachable walled palace on Kandahar's outskirts. And bin Laden began a construction program in Uruzgan, including a new training complex for foreign al-Qaeda volunteers. When the CIA learned about the Uruzgan project, it ordered satellite imagery and agent reports to document the camp. Its officers also hoped bin Laden might wander in for an inspection. Abdullah, Massoud's foreign policy advisor, recalled that the CIA supplied detailed maps of the Uruzgan camp based on satellite photography in the hope that Massoud's agents would mount an attack if bin Laden visited. At one point, a team of four or five Afghan CIA agents with a southern tribal group approached the camp at night to scout it firsthand. Al-Qaeda guards opened fire and wounded one of the agents. Bin Laden opened a similar camp near the Helmand River to the west of Kandahar, but the CIA had few recruits whose tribal and ethnic heritage allowed them to travel comfortably in that area. Kabul was an easier place to spy in than Kandahar. The Afghan capital was a sprawling and ethnically diverse city, a place of strangers and travelers, where any Afghan could claim to belong. At one stage, the CIA's southern tribal team moved north to Kabul's outskirts and rented a farm as a base. They moved in and out of Kabul to scout homes where bin Laden stayed. They developed plans in which, if they had the right intelligence, they would strike a Kabul house where bin Laden slept snatch the Saudi from his bed, and retreat from the city in jeeps. This was a variation on the 1998 plan to attack bin Laden at Tarnak Farm, which had been reviewed skeptically by White House aides and rejected by CIA managers. The tribal group even ordered explosives from the CIA because their plan called for them to blow up small bridges over culverts as they made their escape. The group never acted. Their elaborate plans were not matched by any apparent desire to carry them out. The agents reported about half a dozen aborted attacks. In some cases, they claimed bin Laden had changed routes unexpectedly. In one case, they reported women and children were with bin Laden, and that they held off in compliance with CIA guidance. At the White House, the few Clinton aides who knew about the group had long been cynical about their intentions. Between late 1998 and early 2000, the White House attitude toward the Trodpint team had evolved from hopeful skepticism to outright mockery, as one official recalled it. Now even the CIA, which still valued the group's reporting and defended them against critics, realized they were not likely to mount risky assaults. The CIA's assessment was that the tribal team knew it might succeed in killing bin Laden in a raid, but was likely to suffer heavy losses in the effort. To try to kidnap bin Laden in a city as bustling as Kabul and move him to a safe location while being chased by his bodyguard, as U.S. policy officially required, looked like an implausible episode of Mission Impossible. The group's rented farm, paid for by the CIA, was a working vineyard. Bill Milam, the U.S. ambassador in Islamabad, who was briefed on the operation, would ask his intelligence colleagues sarcastically, "So what are they waiting for? The wine to ferment?" Still, the agents did help map al-Qaeda safehouses around the capital, including three different places where bin Laden stayed and houses frequented by his Egyptian lieutenant, Ayman al-Zawahiri. The CIA's tribal grape growers had been run mainly by case officers in the Near East Division. The new liaison with Massoud offered a chance for the counter-terrorist center to attempt a fresh penetration of Kabul by working through the intelligence service of the Northern Alliance. About half of the capital's population was Tajik. Massoud had a rich network of intelligence sources among Tajik residents and even some Taliban government officials. But bin Laden himself was extremely elusive while in Kabul, recalled Zikrullah Jahid Khan, one of Massoud's intelligence aides. The Saudi might stay in Kabul for two straight months, but he would stay at one base for only 2 or 3 hours. He spent much more time in the eastern mountains and Kandahar than in the capital. Al-Zawahiri and Mohammed Atef were easier to track. The Egyptian doctor spent much of his time in Kabul. Atef traveled frequently to the military front lines around the capital. Recalled an American official, "We said, okay, bin Laden's too hard. How about al-Zawahiri and Atef?" That effort became a focus of day-to-day work between Langley's counter-terrorist center and Massoud's intelligence network. The CIA supplied collection equipment and used satellite photography to validate observations made by Massoud's agents on the ground. Together, they developed a pretty good idea of where the bad guys were, as one American official recalled. One visual signature they relied on was the clustering of luxury sport utility vehicles. Most Afghans did not own cars, much less SUVs. The CIA would put its satellites over Kabul, and its analysts would say, as an official remembered, "Well, 8 Land Cruisers. Someone is bad in that house." But al-Zawahiri's entourage was not as large or as conspicuous as bin Laden's. He was not easy to track. Besides, when Massoud's men began to get a fix, they confronted the problem of legal authorities for lethal operations. The CIA was not permitted to fly into the Panjshir with a sniper rifle and a satellite map of al-Zawahiri's house, even if it could develop one. Any joint operation had to be a plausible, well-planned attempt to capture the Egyptian. When they tried to discuss these kinds of plans with Massoud's men, the Americans found them evasive. As an American official recalled, "The Northern Alliance thought, oh, okay, you want us to capture him. Right, you crazy white guys." Reporting from Massoud's intelligence service and unilateral Afghan agents, however, raised some hope that bin Laden might one day step unwittingly into a Northern Alliance trap. Massoud's aides told the CIA that bin Laden sometimes inspected al-Qaeda troops near Kabul or in northern Afghanistan. Once in a while, bin Laden wandered into the wrong place. In a recent battle northeast of Kabul, Massoud's men reported, bin Laden had gone on an inspection tour and become trapped on the northern side of Massoud's position. He had escaped only by packing out over mountain paths. After the CIA obtained authorities for operations with Massoud, American officials began to hope that bin Laden would mistakenly stray behind Northern Alliance lines one more time. CIA and White House officials also were encouraged to discover that bin Laden had, at least once, traveled all the way to the northern border between Afghanistan and Uzbekistan to the port town of Hayratan on the Amudarya River. According to Afghans who had seen him, bin Laden made speeches there about coming Islamist political and military triumphs in Central Asia. He had wanted to see the sites of his future conquests for himself. The northern border region was controlled by the Taliban, but local commanders often were not committed to the cause. Many had switched their allegiance from Massoud's alliance only recently. The CIA harbored hopes that bin Laden would travel to the far north again. This was one reason they had invested so much effort training and equipping the Uzbekistan commando team. A strike just across the Amudarya border into Uzbek areas of Afghanistan might be relatively easy to mount if they had the right intelligence. Mohammed Atif, too, traveled north to command military operations. He was not as conspicuous or famous a figure as bin Laden, but he might be a more accessible target. Bin Laden's journeys west and north followed a somewhat predictable path. He would ride west on the Ring Road from Kandahar, then loop north and east through Gaur province, where there was a valley he liked to visit. The CIA mapped houses in obscure Gaur, one of Afghanistan's most isolated and impoverished regions. From there, the Saudi usually moved east to Kabul, and then sometimes on to Jalalabad, before turning south again to Paktia and Kandahar. Americans who studied this track called it the circuit. They tried to map reliable reports of bin Laden's movements in great detail. At Richard Clark's counterterrorism security group, they even tried to develop logarithmic formulas that attempted to predict, based on past behavior, where bin Laden was likely to move next when he was at any given point on the circuit. Over time, even the most security-conscious people can repeat themselves out of habit or unconscious instinct. The agency's working idea was to try to keep bin Laden out of KKJ, an insider's acronym for the densely populated cities of Kabul, Kandahar, and Jalalabad. It did not seem plausible after 1999 that a CIA proxy force could mount a successful snatch operation in a Taliban-ruled urban area, but during 2000, bin Laden traveled to rural northern areas less frequently. The CIA picked up reports that he and his men had been intimidated by banditry and robbery gangs on some of the more lawless northern roads where the Taliban's writ did not run. There were no more triumphal speeches on the border of Central Asia, and the Uzbek commandos languished. The CIA developed a specific visual signature for bin Laden's traveling convoy: several land cruisers and a bodyguard of 20 to 100 Arab men. It was the daily work of officers at the counter-terrorist center to develop and discuss specific operational plans for an armed snatch attempt against bin Laden. After the disappearance of the Pakistani commando team, they had three realistic options: the Uzbek commandos, Massoud's forces, or the grape-growing tribal tracking team around Kandahar. The tactical problem was obvious. The CIA's most plausible proxy forces operated in Afghanistan's north, while bin Laden spent most of his time in the south and east. The CIA struggled to find a convincing plan. 6 feet 5 inches tall, chiseled and square-faced, General Hugh Shelton was a civilian's idea of what a general should look like. Defense Secretary William Cohen appointed him chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the top position in the American military, shortly before the Africa embassy bombings. After bin Laden became a pressing national security priority in the autumn of 1998, Shelton seemed an ideal Pentagon partner. He had been a special forces team leader in Vietnam, a commander of elite airborne troops, and finally commander of all American special forces. Unlike many generals, he had direct experience in unconventional tactics, counterinsurgency, and the use of small strike teams in the Third World. As a military leader, he preferred to operate by consultation and consensus. He did not seem to his civilian colleagues an especially original or forceful general, but his record of battlefield valor and field command marked him as an authentic warfighter, not one of the Washington generals who made their careers as uniformed politicians. The White House first asked the Pentagon for detailed military plans to attack and arrest bin Laden in the autumn of 1998. When Shelton and his aides briefed Sandy Berger at the White House, they reported that a boots-on-the-ground operation involving American Special Forces or Army Rangers would require large numbers of troops, thousands, plus aircraft carriers, transport planes, and refueling tankers. Even so, the chances of success were not great, Shelton said. They lacked a foothold in the region, a secure base of operations. We don't have Pakistan, Shelton observed, as Sandy Berger remembered it. We don't have Uzbekistan. We don't have Tajikistan. Without better intelligence than what they were seeing from the CIA, even a well-supported mission was likely to fail, the Pentagon's planners believed. Shelton, Cohen, and their senior aides saw the CIA's reporting from Afghanistan every day. Even as the size and scope of the agency's unilateral agent network grew, the intelligence it produced looked unsound to them as a basis for committing American soldiers to Afghanistan. The CIA's agents simply could not keep track of bin Laden on a daily basis. All we had was a brother who had a brother of a man who was allegedly in his security detail, or the cousin of somebody who had once been told, "Get the feast ready because the Sheikh is coming," remembered a Pentagon civilian who regularly reviewed the CIA's reporting. Cohen recalled telling his colleagues, "We can do this. It's high risk. But if you've got the information to tell us where he is, we will be prepared to recommend that we use force." But Cohen was cautioned by his recent experiences watching U.S. Special Forces hunt, with limited success, for fugitive war criminals in the Balkans. He concluded that someone who exercises good tradecraft is very difficult to locate and capture in enemy territory, and that bin Laden's tradecraft was better than senior Serb war criminals. There was no way to be certain how Taliban troops would react to a U.S. Special Forces raid. Any sensible plan had to assume the Taliban would be hostile. A raid in an urban area, therefore, looked highly dangerous. The CIA's clandestine effort to track bin Laden outside of KKJ and snare him in less heavily defended border areas made more sense in theory, but there was no joint planning with the CIA about this possibility. In any event, the Pentagon saw huge tactical and political problems if the United States tried to operate on its own anywhere near Pakistan. Clinton, Berger, the National Security Council staff, and Pickering at the State Department all saw Shelton as too cautious, too mired in conventional Pentagon doctrine about logistics and force protection. Pickering saw Shelton's slideshows about how many thousands of troops would be required to snatch bin Laden as a standard military position, give us 48 months and 5 divisions. These were gold-plated arguments. They thought, perhaps with some justification, that the NSC and state wanted to correct every problem with them as cannon fodder. Clinton pleaded with Shelton after a cabinet meeting for even a symbolic raid. "You know," the president told the general, "it would scare the shit out of Al-Qaeda if suddenly a bunch of black ninjas rappelled out of helicopters into the middle of their camp. It would get us enormous deterrence and show these guys we are not afraid." But when Shelton returned with an options briefing, his plans all outlined large deployments and cautioned that there would be scant probability of success. Shelton felt the pressure from Richard Clark especially. Clark pressed the Pentagon relentlessly for smaller, stealthier plans to attack bin Laden. Shelton saw the White House counterterrorism chief as a rabid dog. He conceded that, "You need that in government. You need somebody who won't take no for an answer." Still, Shelton and the generals felt Clark and other White House civilians had some dumbass ideas, not militarily feasible. They read something in a Tom Clancy novel and thought you could ignore distances. You can't ignore the time-distance factors. In Special Forces doctrine, the quality of intelligence determines the size of the force required to conduct a raid. The more uncertain the intelligence, the larger the required force. The calculation is as much art as science, but it rests on common sense. If an American Delta Force commando, for instance, is able to watch a target with his own eyes and communicate by secure radio to attacking forces, then a commander can be highly certain about when to launch, and he might feel confident about sending a relatively small force. but if the tactical intelligence is being relayed by non-Americans of uncertain competence or loyalty, and if their intelligence is fragmentary or subject to sudden change, as was the case with the CIA's reporting about bin Laden in Afghanistan, then a commander should size the attacking force to cope with unpredictable resistance.